Support for Fresno Land comes from the San Joaquin Valley Housing Collaborative, hosting a 2-day summit September 10th and 11th in downtown Fresno. Featuring keynote speaker Dr. Manuel Pastor, the summit will unite community organizations, developers, and residents to discuss affordable housing solutions. Learn more and register at sjvhc.org.
Welcome to Fresno Landia. My name is Jordan Maddox. Donnie and I are off this week. I took some time to get out of town and take a little early fall vacation. And in the meantime, we'll be posting an episode from my other podcast program, The History of California Podcast. The focus of this episode was a collaboration with the great water podcast, Water Talk, based out of Davis, California. This episode digs into some of the broader themes around water in California that serves as a complement to last week's episode that focused on water, data centers, and the high-speed rail. I hope you enjoy it, and we'll be back next week to our regular programming. Can we start by discussing in this conversation kind of the circumstances that led to starting Water Talk?
Ooh, that's a good one. Yeah, so I would say that the pandemic was a critical circumstance, I think. Like, for me, I had just started a statewide extension faculty position at the University of California, Davis. And Sam, who is on my mentorship team, one of the things that's recommended when you start a statewide extension position in something like water and agriculture is to travel around the state and meet people. And I started my job in the fall of 2019. So I had planned to travel and all of this stuff. And when the pandemic hit, I couldn't do that. So I was just thinking about ways to travel without traveling and meet people. And I just noticed that there also was like an open area within the UC system to have like different types of voices and highlight different types of expertise related to water. As someone who is just coming onto the scene in California, it seemed like a lot of the same voices were being heard over and over again, and the same types of people were being highlighted for their expertise. And I just noticed that there was a diversity of expertise that could use highlighting. And those are also some of the people I wanted to meet and get to know. So there was this very selfish reason behind it. And it just seemed like a fun thing to do too. Sam, I don't know if you want to comment.
And for me, it was the need to create community when the pandemic hit it. Everyone went to their own corners. And I really want to bring the community, the water community, first internally within the University of California. And then also, I mean, with the community, the larger Californian society. So that was the first one. The second one is very important, what Malika mentioned. I thought it was even a tour and the same narrative of the same people going to these different events, talking about the same and just reiterating. And there was more beyond just the improving efficiencies or water markets. Water is more in California than certain topics. And also, it was the time to provide the microphone to people that were on the ground. And throughout our podcast, we have found that the experts and the expertise sometimes stays in different places, in different locations, that might be different from the narratives that we were listening. So that was that, in my case, stepping out a little bit of my comfort zone. I'm putting a microphone in front of myself and others. I'm a huge admirer of Malika's and Faith's work. So that was also a good way to work with colleagues that you like to work with and that you admire.
Can you share your particular academic backgrounds and what you bring to hosting the show? Because we all have different lenses in how we approach things. I'm a librarian, so I tend to talk about books in my podcasts and historiography quite a bit because that's my bailiwick or whatever. So how do you guys, where's your academic background? How does that color how you produce the show?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have a wild background, like with a lot of twists and turns, in that my bachelor's degree was in cultural studies and comparative literature and philosophy. And that was just like someone who liked to read a lot and didn't quite know what to do with that. is what led me down that path. And then I was in sales for 5 years after my bachelor's degree. I was in pharmaceutical sales. So I've always been really comfortable just talking to people. And that I think also helped with podcasting. And then while I was doing that, I got really interested in sustainable agriculture and soil, and I became a master gardener, and that took me back to school. And I got a master's in soil science. And when I did my master's, it took me to thinking about stormwater and drainage. That was what my master's thesis was about, was looking at how different types of vegetation, when they're planted in these little stormwater infrastructures called rain gardens, how they function hydrologically by changing the water budget. And then I fell in love with the water budget. And so for my PhD, I got really into irrigated agriculture and just thinking about every aspect about it, how to do a better job with it, how to be better, advise better irrigators, how irrigation impacts the climate and vice versa, and how we can think of irrigation as a land use change and its impacts on both ground and surface waters. So that was my path.
And in my case, I'm born and raised in Mexico City. I literally grew on top of pavement and playing soccer on the streets. So that was fun. Did most of my academic background in Mexico, a civil engineer, recovered, but still a civil engineer. And sometimes it comes through because I really want to fix the stuff. Then did also there my master's degree, moved to University of Texas at Austin, civil and environmental engineering. But I think something that really changed what I was doing is finding that water can help. It's not only something technical, but also it has a societal benefit. And that was the part that caught my attention. It also comes with the politics. So that's another aspect there. And as I was doing all of this, I did a lot of work on the Rio Grande, now in the Colorado, Tijuana, and then start working, having this experience between what is happening in Mexico and what are the things that people manage water in Mexico and vice versa in the US and so on. So always having those dual lenses. Then in California, I start working. I'm an environmental close guy, and you know, want it or not, I really like the environment. Reservoirs reoperations, I also like reservoirs, so that kind of come as a conflict there. Irrigation districts, I work quite a lot with irrigation districts. Did a lot of work on managed aquifer recharge. At that point, it was called groundwater banking. And later in California, I started working with farm workers, farm managers, and farmers. And that one allowed me to move from what a businessman wants for their farm, what a person who deals with the workers and the businessman operates, and how they try to put those things together, and what the workers do. And I don't know, I have learned quite a lot from all of those experiences.
So my next question is related to public-facing academic work. So I'm curious, two things. One, how your colleagues see the work you're doing with the podcast. Some academics can be more insular. Some want to put themselves out there in every possible context and situation. And so I'm curious your colleagues' perception of the work you're doing with the podcast. And then secondarily, what the state of kind of interdisciplinary work looks like in the field of water.
Sam, why don't you take it?
So with our colleagues, I've seen good feedback. I think they kind of see us as brave enough to put a microphone in front of us and be able to talk to a lot of these issues. It also comes with the problem of, hey, would you mind inviting me to your podcast? Which that also we have had a fair share of those. But the point is, in our case, we always try to focus on our vision ahead, which is what are the key topics, the relevant topics, and the people that have firsthand experiences on this that can help us out. Something that I think the best way that I have updated myself in water in California is through interviewing and listening our podcast. It is amazing how these have kept me up to date on the issues that are. And what was the second question?
The second question is the state of interdisciplinary science. Where is it at with water in California? Are you able to cross a lot of disciplines and work with people in different contexts?
Yeah, absolutely. I am an interdisciplinary scientist. I would say my master's was in soil, but my PhD, I was at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and the program is through the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, and it's called Environmental Resources, and it was an interdisciplinary PhD program. That's why I think I knew just enough to be dangerous to try the podcast. I took a social science course during my PhD, and it was about ecological science fiction, and we worked and we created some audio pieces, and we did some editing, and it was really cool. And that's why I knew how to edit a little bit, as I said, just enough to be dangerous with a podcast. So definitely for me, my position is soil plant water relations, and I do think of all of those things. All of my projects are very interdisciplinary. I try to collaborate with engineers and hydrologists like Sam. I try to collaborate with soil ecologists. I am working with people who really can think about ecosystems and aspects of them that all go together. And I'll give a specific example. A lot of the work that's done on irrigation is done by engineers. And here in the state of California, we've been moving in this water efficiency direction, and then also moving in this soil health direction. And we really need to think about those things together. So a lot of the projects that I have in my lab are looking at efficiencies and changes to irrigation to save water, but also how those changes impact things that we care about, like soil carbon pools and sequestration and soil health and soil functionality. And those things really should go together. So I feel good about interdisciplinary science.
Yeah, I love the state of that. And I love that we're moving back to the Alexander von Humboldt universe, where we see everything as interconnected and we can see the patterns and the connections there. And I think people being sequestered in their disciplines makes sense for a time, because you want to be an expert where you know, but eventually we all need to work together in order to move forward. So I completely agree with you. We're going to jump into a bunch of questions now around topography, climate, infrastructure. We'll start with kind of a simple one. Do you think it's helpful to talk about California water issues, or should we talk about microclimates and regional issues? Because in some ways, talking about California is talking about a varied, large landscape that has many different microclimates. Is it even helpful to talk about California water issues beyond just legislation that affects everybody?
Very good question. We are always flipping a coin when, sorry, October 1st, when the water year starts, we just go there, flip a coin, and then we'll see what is coming. I do think that it's important to keep it in the bigger perspective, because we really forget about things that happen. So let me be painfully clear. Last 12 years, 8 years we have had rain below average. So what that means is that now flipping a coin is actually not flipping a coin, because 2/3 of the time will fall on one side and 1/3 will fall on the other. And we also, unfortunately, have of the years that have been wet, we have different wet years. We have, wet, but with rain and warm. We have had wet with snow and cold, and wet with snow and warm. So what I'm trying to tell you is that the Sierra Nevada, I make the joke that the Sierra Nevada is no longer that Nevada at all, but it is sometimes Nevada, sometimes not. So for me, that's the good part to remind everyone. This year, right, El Niño, and then we had a previous year with a lot of precipitation, and that's what you're also talking about, the climate sometimes is not helpful. This year, we are like, okay, don't worry, we had a huge water year, and now El Niño year, we're going to have good amount of water. It hasn't rained. It hasn't rained, and I'm really crossing my fingers, before Thanksgiving, we have a good storm. Otherwise, we're heading to the place that we know now 2/3 of the time, which is dry years. We have reservoirs full and so on that will damper. But I do think that at least on my side, everyone should know what is an atmospheric river, where do we fall our snow, the snow line, how climate is changing all of our water conditions, and so on.
Yeah, it seems like it's a both and thing. Localism makes sense because that's where our information comes from. But then if you only know that, then you get those people that say, it's rained where I live, like, 10 times this year. We don't have water issues. And it's like, for example, I'm going to Yosemite this weekend for kind of an annual winter trip. I'm into cold plunges, so I'm going to go swimming safely. But in any case, it's snowing currently in Yosemite right now. And then I could deduce from that, oh, things are fine with water. But that's just a small picture. So I agree with you. If you could have listeners understand one thing better about the climate in California that would help them make better sense of water and the state of water, what would that one thing be? What do you think people misunderstand most about climate and water in California?
Yeah, I think for me, it would be understanding time. So understanding annual cycles versus decadal cycles versus centuries of time. For example, I think most people who study water got driven a little while when people said the drought is over, our water problems are over, when we had that all of the flooding and the extreme precipitation last year. So I think it's really critical for people to understand the time scale at which, for example, groundwater is operating. We have to think decadally when it comes to something like groundwater. That would be my one thing.
Okay. And I'm going to piggyback on that, because that was my next question. Is it just time to kill the word drought and come up with more specific terms to describe things? Because drought is used like the word, I don't know, God or something. It can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. Do we need something that's like more specific that describes kind of variations on a theme, if you will?
Yes, I think so. And so drought preparedness rather than drought response. I think that will be one thing. The other one is that, so the droughts only highlight the problems that we already have. And when the drought is gone, it's just taking an aspirin and now you're not feeling the headache, but it will come back, the migraine, like rest assured. I think it will be a permanent state of water conservation. The long story short, in many places in California, we're using more water than what we have. And again, we did some magic. So basically take water from the ground and pretty much inflating what we're using. I think the drought, I think, is a permanent water conservation state that hopefully will lead us to a place where we can manage better not so rainy and very rainy years.
I want to jump into ag now, because I'm located in the Central Valley, in the San Joaquin Valley, where a lot of the water issues in ag are most present. Can you complicate people's picture of agriculture and water for a second? I think that there tends to be monolithic pictures, right? People in the Central Valley have a defensive posture. If you drive the 99, you'll see what that looks like in terms of signs. I lived in Southern California in the Bay Area. They have very particular points of view on how much water it takes to produce an almond. And the kind of polarized understanding of ag and water has both led to both misunderstandings and also the inability to have conversations about progress. So can you talk a little bit and complicate the picture for us?
Ooh, this is a good one. I think for me to do my job, right, I work on agricultural water management, and I did come to it from a place of conservation and interest, and I'm in extension, so I work with farmers. So I have to be able to have this very pluralistic way of being and thinking about it. And I think that for me, I approach it by just assuming that people are fundamentally good and trying to do the best that they can, and that incremental change is positive. And that's how I am approaching my work. Like, I have my own personal opinions sometimes and visions for what I want things to look like, but I don't know how to solve the problem of agricultural water use and depletion in the Central Valley. Like, I don't have a clear-cut solution. And I think Sam and I have talked about this. There's not a single solution. And just from a productivity standpoint, the entire country and world in some ways relies on California agriculture and the production as it currently is in the Central Valley. And if it were to change, then it would go somewhere else. So, like, we, for what we consume and what we eat and what we want, It has to grow somewhere.
I like my baklava. Yeah. I like my baklava and I want those pistachios. So it makes sense to me. Yeah. One particular issue that I feel like people maybe don't understand completely is groundwater and aquifers. Can you clarify what those terms mean? Similar to drought in that we use them liberally without maybe understanding the actual scientific basis for them.
Yeah, Jordan, let me actually go back to the...
Okay, sorry, I just jumped. I'm like a train. I'm moving. Sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Let me confuse by pointing out a number. In California, we said we are the breadbasket of the United States. Between nut trees, which is walnuts, almonds, and pistachios, alfalfa, hay, and corn, so feedstock, grapes, rice, and tomatoes. So nut trees, grapes, alfalfa, rice, and tomatoes is 66%, two-thirds of the acreage in California. So let me be very clear. When we're talking about the breadbasket, it's only planted in one-third, it's not in the entire state. So if people ask, like, we don't have the land, no, yes, we have it. And, we're running out of land, no, yes, we have it. But we are deciding to grow crops that... Agriculture is an economic enterprise. Yes, they are growing food. I get it. And I really love the food. But it is an economic enterprise. Just be aware that behind it, there is economic profit. I do want to distinguish between the non-responsible, non-socially or non-environmentally responsible agriculture. The one that is large scale, the one that pollutes our aquifers, the one that pay bats our farm workers, the one that use pesticides, fertilizers, the one that pollutes the air. That one, I am personally, I'm not in favor of. The one that works with the community, that pays good salaries, that try to do sustainable agricultural practices. And if there is a farmer that is listening, I'm with you anytime. And I can help you defend anytime. The ones that are not being socially, environmentally responsible, I'm sorry. I also don't have the appetite to work on it. So those are two things. The third one, to confuse our listeners, is farmers, farm managers, and farm workers. The owner of the land, the person that is providing resources that can be synthetic fertilizer, nitrogen, other supplies, and then the farm workers. And I think people get confused between a farm worker and a farmer. They are different and so on. So that to avoid the confusion.
Yeah.
And well, I guess one last thing on this. Sorry, I just wanted to say, building on what Sam was saying, that I just want people to try. So I understand that people are oftentimes in situations where you're managing your fertilizer in a certain way, or you're managing it, you know, your soils in a certain way. But if you're curious and you want to try to incorporate sustainable soil and water conservation practices, then that's enough. Just understanding that the change can be incremental.
Yeah, okay, I think philosophically, I think we need to really absorb, particularly the work of Will McCaskill, who just published a book called What We Owe the Future. And thinking about future generations and that the environment that they will grow up in, I think that should at least play 25% role, 35% role in our decision-making. We have to do what's best right now, of course. That should be more than half. But there should be an element that thinking about the future that guides our decision-making at the margins, at least. But I know that's challenging private enterprise and working with people that have bottom lines. Let's jump back to the groundwater and aquifers question, though. What can you explain those terms so maybe people could have a better understanding when they're used casually in journalism about the state of water?
So those two are extremely simple. So groundwater is water in the ground. Just it is that simple. And the aquifer is the container. So it is the bucket. And in that case, the bucket is filled sometimes with sediment, so with sand, gravel, clay. And in between those is the water. So groundwater, water in the ground, aquifer, the container.
Okay. The next one, and I'm just defining terms here because I think it's helpful for me and helpful for listeners. What do you think people most misunderstand about snowpack?
Ooh, that's very interesting. I think, Sam, you should take this if you have something passionate.
No, perhaps more than misunderstand. Okay, it really, it depends. The snowpack depends on two things: that actually falls as snow, and we have seen some years that it's not falling as snow. The other one that we have cold conditions, and we have also seen those, that even though we have good precipitation, it doesn't mean that we're going to have a good snowpack. And even though we have a good snowpack, if it is warm, we're going to lose it faster than what we think. Those two.
Okay.
That's great. That was more eloquent than I was thinking about it. I was like, it's that things that are rain or atmospheric rivers aren't always snow, but you said it way better.
Okay. One more kind of environmental question before we talk about infrastructure. Can you explain why the soil where I live in the Central Valley has so much arsenic, mercury, and toxins in it?
No, I can't explain that unless you can, Sam, quickly.
No, I know that they are in some parts are a natural condition. So we have the minerals underneath that they have produced naturally arsenic and some of those. We used to have all the way back the Corcoran Lake. So basically the entire Central Valley was a lake. And it came with some salt or water from the ocean. So that's why we have the west side more saline than the east side, because on the west side, they were more the positions of salt. But why we have arsenic on the ground, I do not know. What I do know is that I think it is not cool to use that water for supplying people. And unfortunately, it is already happening. I know that in the Central Valley, it has happening. Where I've seen it firsthand is in the Coachella Valley. And it really, there have been two or three times where I have actually have this loss of faith or loss of enthusiasm about what things are going on. One was when I was in Coachella Valley, seeing a well that was pumping water with arsenic, that some people were drinking that water, even though it was treated. That part, it really broke my heart. And perhaps related with that is not cool to do that.
Yeah, it's something I think about being where I am quite a bit is water issues and pollution. And a lot of these communities, particularly tract homes that are put in and then are supported by various wells. And we get our water tested regularly and I'm regularly terrified. So let's jump into
Yeah, I balked right away because I was like, soil mineralogy. Oh boy. Maybe an interesting, I think, episode for you to do if you haven't done it would be the history of soil in California. You could ask Toby Eugene to come on and tell you about all the reason why the soil is everywhere it is. That is, I think some people loved that topic in soil science, but for me, I thought it was really interesting, but that's why I was like, oh God, I'm not touching it.
Yeah, I'm sure that would be a 3-hour episode for me. I want to talk now about infrastructure, and we can just summarize at a broad scale here. How have dams and irrigation changed the landscape of California?
I think for me, I was just going to say, I'm from the Midwest, right? So I came to California as an outsider. And what I realized about water and how it's used in this state is this state has plumbing at a complex level that didn't exist in where I was from, which is Wisconsin, and I grew up in Minnesota. So I think that to a listener who's not very familiar with water, I just think of it as plumbing. Like the whole state of California is completely plumbed with storage and pipes and everything, just moving stuff around to where it's needed. That's how I think about it.
And when you say how it has changed, so we used to be at least a third to 40% of wetland. And since the late, the 1890s, 1910s, we have a reclamation districts. So they were reclaiming the land, basically levying or building a lot of levees and drying the land so it can be farmed. Now you have arable land and you have some containment of the river, but you need more water, right? And in that case, let's build big pockets. And we just build them around the Sierra Nevada. And those are called the dam rims. the rim dams. So basically dams that are along the rim at the foothills of the Sierra Nevada. The third one is that what Malik is mentioning, which is now we need water not only in all those places, but also along the coast and Southern California. So we need to build the pipes and moving water down there. I do also think that agriculture 1920s, 1910s with the diesel pump, it really starts taking water from the ground at an impressive scale. And with that, it came land subsidence and a very evil cycle of, if you can bring me water, I will stop doing this. And then you bring the water. Actually, that was a first good attempt. Let's try it again. And we did it two or three times with the Central Valley Project, the State Water Project, until Sigma is putting some breaks on that one. It's been 100 years of groundwater overdraft. So I think that one at a bigger scale, I think different regions have different stories.
Yeah. Another big infrastructure project that's had a lot of controversy is the LA Aqueduct. There's been great scholarly research. There's been great kind of popular nonfiction. There was even a great movie with Jack Nicholson all about this particular issue and project. What would you say the legacy of the LA Aqueduct is, and what lessons does it have to teach us about things like water issues in Syria that are causing instability? And should we care about the Owens Valley?
I do. I was there early on the year. I was actually at Owens Lake. So we still have native tribes there that they were moved outside, that they are coming back. So what is the legacy that people were displaced and they came back? We should support them. What other legacy that is distinctive? And they mentioned at least it was bought by LA. So we still have native vegetation. It hasn't been, the land use hasn't changed to agricultural farming. So we still have good places where we can protect the environment, protect the native land use. The legacy is that of all the piping, we have disconnected the people from their water source. We have people in LA that receive water all the way from Wyoming, from Colorado, New Mexico, from Indio, Mono County, from Lassen, Modoc, Sierra counties, Trinity County. So we just disconnected. And I think the legacy is that we are now trying, as we are doing it with our ancestry, tracing our ancestry route. Now we need to do the same with water in California, trace our water sources. I don't know. I think this always reminds me that not only knowing where the water is coming from, but also how can we help? How can we sustain the communities, support the communities that live there, that help us with our water? In the Sierras, fire management, a good land use, foresting, and partnering them. So anyway.
Okay. On that note, there's been a lot of movement to remove some dams from California. And I think undergirding that, there's this kind of somewhat kind of a romanticism about, can we go back? Can we go back to that verdant landscape that Los Angeles was? Can we go back? We have a Tulare Lake right now. I don't know if you guys have driven past it, but I have, and I've seen it, and I've got friends with drones that have flown their drones over the top of it. So I've been able to see it. But in some sense, we just can't go back is my inclination. But I also think that there could be things positive that come from removing some of the dams. Where do you both stand on this issue of dam removal?
I guess on the issue of can we go back, there's a really interesting idea of how water moves actually in soil. And it's called hysteresis. And it's that water, if you look at the path by which water wets and dries, it's always two different paths. And that's how I feel about the future of water as I do in California, and how we need to think about development is in a forward-looking way that takes lessons from the past, integrates it into the future. But some of the things that we haven't really talked much about that I'd like to see, and I think are critical on agricultural landscapes especially, would integrate some of the ideas of the past, like grazing within perennial landscapes, but then also like sci-fi ideas like agrivoltaic systems. So I think that the future is going to be something that's different, but maybe learns the lessons of the past.
And in my case, related with removing some of the dams, I think, again, it is the nuances, is in the detail. So we're removing dams in the Trinity River, Iron Gate, and that is a small dam, and it was just to divert, do some hydropower. That specific dam, is what is called a cache dam. What does that mean? That the irrigation district on top and what they were planting, which is alfalfa, when the Bureau of Reclamation did all that analysis, it didn't came as net benefit positive. So all the money that we were putting in there, it wasn't enough to make sure that it will be economically feasible. So we needed to bring more money. How can we bring more money? Let's create a hydropower and generate that so we can subsidize farmers there. That one has will be removed, and we have plenty of cash dams. All the Sierra Nevada, and if you go to the San Joaquin River, you're gonna find a lot of cash dams. In that specific case, water will be, it will allow for connect the migration of the salmon all the way to places where it has a good habitat. Why this is important? Because you, Jordan, Malika, myself, and everyone who pays taxes in California, we're paying for fisheries. Yes, part of our taxes goes to pay for fisheries that produce fish, that put it in there, and all the equipment there. That it is very costly, and in that case, we're trying to save some. I don't think all the dam will come down. And for instance, I don't see a San Luis Reservoir or Frian Dam coming down. Why not? Because it has a specific purposes. Something that it is very important. I really don't want anyone in the state, and actually in any part of the world, that do not have access to water. And I think, to me, that is extremely clear. And in that case, dams are very helpful. Hetch Hetchy, we have, you mentioned Owens Valley, we have the Colorado Aqueduct and Feather, Oroville, and so on. I don't think all of them, I think, but we should recognize their purposes.
Okay. Let's jump into a few historical questions before we close with books. First in use, first in right. This kind of goes back to the beginning of the state. And there was two major movements. There was the movement to divert water. That was for the gold rush, so they can use hydraulic drilling, mining, I should say. And then there was also the use of, if you own land near a river, you need water to access for your agriculture. And those two competing interests converged. Now, the one that kind of won out there was agriculture, in part because of the economy of the state. How do you think about how those particular interests have affected water use going forward in the state?
Just a quick note for the listeners, we have an episode 41, Dam History, that actually talks about dams. Make sure that we have, that you read, listen to that one with Barsha. So first in time, first in right. So the first thing is that it allowed for colonizers to have the first dips on whatever we have right now, the current water rights system. And that one created a disproportion of who comes first related to who has migrated. Everyone in California is a migrant, just with the 1% that it is not there, that are Native Americans. All of us migrated there. That created a disproportion advantage with who has water and who has not. The one other thing is that this, because land was not allowed for the native tribes, the native community members, they didn't water, nor to land, nor to water. So I think that created a problem there. And currently, I think what we're seeing is that whoever has the oldest water rights will get as much water as we have. We have seen the drought. We've seen that I will not say not necessarily the more efficient use, but there is a way that you might be cut off without other ones not being cut off. And personally, I prefer to spread the load among everyone than just having very few having the burden and some of them having not the burden.
What the hell is a water bank?
Oh, what an interesting question. I think of it physically. Like I think at one way of thinking about it is an aquifer. or like when we think about groundwater recharge and groundwater banking, as Sam was saying, like we think about finding appropriate aquifers to store water for the future. And I think we think about the physical characteristics of what would make an aquifer a good water bank. and its activities? Does it have a bunch of limiting layers here and there that are going to make it tricky to recharge it and store water? And is it aptly situated where we can store water and then move it around in it? So when you bring up water bank, I think of it very physically right away.
Any water storage, and it can go from aquifers. Reservoirs is another water bank. We know how much water comes in, how much water went diverted. The water barrels, rainwater harvesting, that would be exactly the same. We're having our small piggy bank that we're home.
Yeah, it's a little water bank.
Yeah, what is a corollary to that? What is paper water?
Oh, boy. Sam, do you want to take this? I'm not touching it.
No, so basically, so you have a water right or a metric amount in a paper that is called the warranty, the water warranty. But that means, it doesn't mean that you're going to get it every year. Basically, it's an amount of water that you have on your water, but you do not know if you're going to get it or not.
Yeah, I think that was a confusing concept to understand for sure. Because I was trying to, I have some projects where I work with processing tomato growers who are in the Westlands aquifer region. And they have water allocations. And for the first couple of years that I was here, they were getting 0% water or 5% water. And then when we had that very wet year, they got 35% of their allocation. So I think it's just hard and interesting to think about what would 100% allocation look like for them with their paper water? And have they ever gotten it? It seems like maybe not.
No, and actually that is, and in that one, I don't blame them. The state made very high estimates of how much water the state will be able to provide. And the reality is that water never came through the pipe. So typically what I think is 50% will be 100% or their maximum allocation. In that case, 35 will be like 70%. And yeah, I don't know. The state in that one, I think, oversold what that project was looking like.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of the water pollution acts. There's the Dickey Water Pollution Act. There's the Port of Cologne Act. Do you think California water has been made safe? If not, why? And then I want to ask you both, do you filter your water and how at home?
I think California water has been made safe for some people. I think that's the biggest issue, right? Is I think that we have this public right to water. There's a right to clean, safe water. And I think it's amazing that right to water exists. There's a human right to water in the state, but it's not actualized for many people who live in the Central Valley, for example, who are not afforded safe, healthy drinking water. I have one of those fridges that has a filter in it. So my water does get filtered because I like cold water from my fridge. So that's why I would say, I don't know what if I filter it if I didn't have the fridge filter. But it is just a very basic, it's not like a super complex system.
So the regulations allowed for protecting the water. However, when it was not protected, it took some time to actually get at the root of the cause of the contamination. And eventually it went there. So we have the Port of Cologne Act, and then out of that, some of the ordinances for discharge of dairy and act, and for the application of fertilizer. So what I'm trying to tell you is that our water is safe, but once it has passed the limit, then it is not preventive. It's just, okay, now just pass. So now we have to figure out where it is coming and if it is spread out. I don't know. I think that's part of the deal. Not necessarily that is good. For my case, I do have a 5-filter system under the sink. I really have that. And this is very sad. So Davis is surrounded by Aglan. And I don't know, at that point, we were about to pass some of the limits, decided to go for it. The caveat with that is that even though you have a 5-filter system, you have to change the filters. So if anyone who is listening to us has a filter system under the sink, make sure that you change the filters. I do it typically on Thanksgiving. So days coming up on Thanksgiving, my wife always tells me like, hey, come on. Some change the filter.
Yeah, I have reverse osmosis under my sink as well. So I think we need to get Malika on team filtration. So we'll work on that. All right, two topics before we close. One, I want to give each of you a chance to share a particular episode with Water Talk. And I want you to pick an episode that caused you to change your mind most.
Oh boy, that's super interesting. Sam, do you have one that comes to mind right away? Change my mind.
I do. And actually, so I have way too many favorites, but let me see if I find this one.
I guess another way of asking is, which episode caused you to learn the most from your guests?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have one that comes to mind. I would say episode 38, which is Ag in the Delta. Because as a relative newcomer to California, my whole vision of the Delta was as a place of conflict. And I was thinking about it just as this place where there's a lot of water conflict, there's conflict over resources. It's sitting in this junction between, you know, the Sacramento Valley and the San Joaquin Valley, like thinking about just how water is moving. I just had that vision of it as a conflict place. And that episode made me want to go there. And it made me appreciate all of the diversity that's there, all just want to visit it as an exciting and beautiful place. Very shortly after we did that episode, I went to the Delta because I wanted to see it, because it is just so interesting and unlike any place in California. So it changed my perspective, because I hadn't thought of it as the potential for being like a beautiful and exciting place with all the birds and everything. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah, I lived in Stockton for 1 year while my partner did postgraduate work at UOP. And I enjoyed just like seeing this landscape that I just didn't realize existed. And watching these massive barges just float by Stockton and just being blown away that this was California. So it was astounding.
Or just that there are ports there.
I know.
I was like, there are ports here? What's going on?
So
yeah,
wild.
It's wild. Yeah, very interesting.
What about you, Sam? What episode jumps out to you?
So episode 23, and that is Advancing Water Justice in Underserved Communities. And this one is, it really highlights that disadvantaged communities are underrepresented by the media. So there is some coverage, but not as frequent as all. Underserved by the government. What that means is that there is some legislations or budget that passes, but not as much as it passes for other communities. And understudied by us, the academics. And that actually, it has been a good reflection. I always think that it's super cool when an academic says that it is doing some work with an underrepresented community in some other part of the world, but we have those here in our backyard. And that really, it was a call for myself to switch gears on what I was thinking and to start working with people, to be more proactive, to work with people that are underrepresented in our state.
Yeah, we all love it when academics throw a rope out the side of the window and shimmy down that tower and then come out here with the rest of us and get engaged in problems in the real world. It's obviously producing knowledge is so important, but translating that is equally as important, I think. And on that note, we're going to close with books. So I want to give you a chance to share three books you'd recommend. And I'm going to challenge Malika, since she brought it up earlier, to share at least one fiction, something related to water or the environment. I've been rereading after her death. I've been reading a lot of Ursula Le Guin, because the big biography of her is coming out next year. And I'm so looking forward to reading that and her works. Particularly, I just worked with some students on The Lathe of Heaven, which is actually a really fun novel that's a novella of hers where someone's dreams can change the world and a therapist tries to get involved and manipulate the dreams to create paradise. And you can imagine what happens, but there's a lot of great work around water and environment. Why don't we start with Sam so we can give Malika a chance to think of some fiction?
Let me actually start with the Les Colons books. So there is The Settler Sea, which is California's Salton Sea and the Consequences of Colonialism. And that is by Tracy Boyles. We interviewed her, episode 48. So bringing literally how the Salton Sea is a settler sea, how it displays the communities there. Another one that is really good is the book by Beth Rose Middleton Manning that is called Upstream, Trust Lands and Power on the Feather River. And again, seeing it from the tribal communities. When I started the podcast, I was trying to get myself a good handle on how the tribes are looking, what are their views. And actually, those two will be good. Footnote in that one. When you were mentioning about that, we have at some point in the interview, like we have current needs, but we should be also thinking or looking in long terms for all the actions that we have. Something that I learned from our indigenous communities is that they look from 3 to 6 generations ahead. So decisions that they are making, they are doing it 3 to 6 generations ahead. And that is a good mindset for us to think of our decisions. Now, one that I think it is tangential of water, or it has the water, but it explains the land use. And with the land use, how all the water moving to that is in the struggle. Scholars and the Fighting Against Industrial Agribusiness in California by Daniel O'Connell. We also interviewed him. It really shows the, he mentioned that it really shows the corruption. It is, he, with his words, he mentioned that it is Cadillac Desert on steroids. And it is, if you read it, you will figure out how the government and the companies, they work together to have the landscape that we have right now, which is an industrial agribusiness. And also I agree with him. It is so permeated. It has changed so much our environment that we cannot untangle. We just think this is the way that it should be. But Darwin in the Struggle, highly recommended. That is another book that really changed my mind.
Yeah, so I have a few for fiction. I think with the movies coming out and to inspire maybe youth out there, if you haven't read Dune, it is a classic. And I think, I don't know, it was maybe one of the first most like formative science fiction books on water for me that I read, because it's really about water, but it's also about soil and it's about ecology and it's about politics and it's about so many things. There's parts of it that definitely did not age. So just full disclaimer on that. But that was one kind of a classic, and especially with the movies coming, I think that's, or the new movie and then the old, you know, the movie that came out last year. And then I think one of my favorite books that is a fiction book about water for people who haven't read it is called The Water Knife. And it's by Paolo Bassi Galuppi. And hopefully, sorry if you're listening, Paolo, if I got your name wrong. But it is, I like to read books that are cli-fi, so climate science, climate change based science fiction. So it is a book that stayed with me a lot. So there, it's not one, you can picture it really happening. There's enough of it that feels like it could be a future, a disturbing future, but a future that is focused on water conflicts between states in the Southwest and in the American West. And I don't know, it just really hit me. So that one was really good. Similar type of book, also cli-fi, based on water, is called Gold Fame Surface. And that book was by, or is by Claire Watkins. And again, it's a future. It is a little bit apocalyptic in California and centered around water shortages and what happens to families and what happens to people and when water starts to run out. So I do these apocalyptic books and they're not for everyone. Like I had my husband read Water Knife and he had like nightmares. So just full disclosure on that. But those are some. And then another classic, if you haven't read Parable of the Sower by Octavia Butler, also really, once again, it's like more ecological, client picturing a future, but water, I think, is a part of it.
Have you read any Kim Stanley Robinson, like Ministry of the Future?
Yeah.
Because okay. He's local. He's in Davis, future. Right?
He is, but I feel like that would be like, that's what I would have been expected to say.
Yeah. I was waiting for that one, but it didn't come. And so yeah. I was sure it was there. All right. To close, what are you both working on in your respective domains currently? And then what can we expect from the podcast going forward?
Oh, wow. current domains, like I'm doing a lot of work, and I think Sam, you are too, because we have some projects together. I'm doing a lot of work in kind of two main strains. One area that we're doing a lot of work is on this cover crop question in the Central Valley. There's a lot of debate about, are cover crops worth it? And we did do an episode called Cover Crop Hydroeconomics, thinking about this issue of there is some cover crops, like any plants do use some water, but they do provide a tremendous amount of benefits. But there's some debate about their water cost and their water use and whether they should be used in California agriculture. So I'm studying that question, and I have a large project with that Sam's a part of, where we're looking at cover crop water use and like a new designer cover crop. So that's one thing. Another thing that I'm focusing a lot on is just the future of precision irrigation and irrigation management. Like, we have a drones program in our lab, and we do high resolution mapping of evapotranspiration, which is crop water use, and thinking about how best to use these types of tools. How is the precision always worth it? Where does it make sense? How can we manage water as cleverly as possible?
And in my case, I have a different project, the same as Malik. So one is related with irrigation, that project, and also training irrigation applicators, trying to develop courses for, in this case, irrigators, farm workers that are irrigators, and how they can improve their water application, save water, and also reduce the use of synthetic fertilizer. Human right to sanitation, we're working to with the state to assess what is the state of the sanitation, and then see if we can have a human right to sanitation, similarly as we have the human right to water. We have the working along the border, still projects with the Rio Grande, Colorado, bringing the scientists together, training local elected officials. So I've been working quite a lot to develop materials to train county board of supervisors, council board members, school district members, to actually train them better, or not actually not train them better, to allow to, so they learn how to learn. We are actually providing that much of a context, but they are, we're providing the tools so they learn how to learn. And the thing that they are learning how to learn is on water issues, but they can do it in other specific topics. That is the great part, that we are training them at this, at the beginning with water. They can learn to learn how to learn in other topics, so they can do better decisions. And I think that's it.
Okay. And what do we expect from the podcast going forward?
Yeah, I think that we have a lot of ideas, so we don't want to give too much away, but I think I would say that we may actually expand the scope of it a little bit, because Faith, for example, has taken a role in science communication in Arizona. So we're starting to get in and think about, like what we said earlier, trying to think about larger issues that affect more of the geography, but then still have that local perspective as best as we can by telling stories. Yeah, I think that's all I feel I want to give away right now.
And I think this is great, because we get sometimes really California-centric. California has a lot of gravity, and I think that's fine. But sometimes looking things from different angles or in other places can help us out to put what we have in perspective. Sometimes good, sometimes bad. I was the example that I always made, the CIMIS stations. So the stations that we have on evapotranspiration, we have, I don't know, more than 100, 120. And so there are states that only have, what, 3, 4, 7? So when we think about it, it is sometimes mind-blowing. And having those different perspectives, I think, will help us out to value what we have or to learn listening from other places.
Yeah. And I don't say this to everybody, but I'm definitely saying it to you too. I love your podcast so much. It's one of my favorites regionally that I listen to. And I think it's really important. And I was having a conversation with someone about this recently. I think one of the best things that you can do in terms of your knowledge development is understand your utilities. We just had Catherine Blunt on the show, who wrote a wonderful book called California Burning about PG&E, both its bankruptcies and also the fires that resulted from it, specifically Paradise. And I think, like, understanding the grid is a great way to be a knowledgeable consumer in California. Understanding water is a great way to be a knowledgeable consumer, because a lot of these things that maybe people consider mundane, and no offense, might consider boring, talking about water, talking about electricity production. Those are oftentimes
what?
The most, I know, I'm not, it's a caricature I'm creating. Oftentimes those things impact our life more than the things that we maybe pay attention to. And so I know it's hard to supplement reading about the grid versus looking at TikTok, but I think it will benefit you more in the long run to understand just how your society works, how your systems work. So I really do appreciate the work that you both do, as well as your other hosts. And I appreciate you talking with me today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.